Thank you very much. It really is an honor to be with you this evening. It's the first time I've visited this part of the world with its extraordinary history, a part of the world that in part drove an industrial revolution powered by coal, a substance that is going to be increasingly important in coming decades, very likely, as oil becomes increasingly scarce. And that's bad news from the point of view of climate change, as you probably all realize, because coal, for every unit of energy generated, releases much more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I'm delighted to be here, too, also because I think that this conference is focusing on exactly the right subject. I've been working on climate change issues for over two decades. One of the few social scientists, I think, probably, who has consistently tried to think through the implications of climate change. There are many more now starting to populate this discussion. But one thing I've come to realize, especially in the last few years, is that the solutions to our climate change crisis on this planet are going to reside largely at the level of culture. Now, we have a conversation that's going on right now through the UNFCCC process, the Kyoto process, and Copenhagen coming up, that emphasizes technology and economics, strategies for dealing with the problem that are highly technical, very important, and I don't want to disparage or these approaches or suggest that they shouldn't be pursued. But the fact remains that we seem to be falling further and further behind. The problem is getting worse. The scientists tell us the problem seems to be developing faster than was expected even a few years ago. Carbon sinks around the world seem to be saturating. The situation in the Arctic is changing much faster than was expected. We're perhaps 20 to 50 years ahead of model predictions. And yet, when we look at what's being proposed in terms of the technical solutions, the institutions, and the economic approaches, they seem pallid by comparison. They seem to not even come close to what we need to achieve. And I've become increasingly convinced that the solutions ultimately reside at the level of culture, most broadly defined, at the level of our values, our social relations, our behavior patterns, the deep assumptions we have about the world, the way we see the world. Now, one might say, well, if that's the case, then it's impossible to change because these things are so resistant to change and perhaps only change over generations. But I don't think we should listen to that counsel of despair, because I'm convinced that in our world today, in part because of some of the remarkable technologies we have available to us, and in part because of the extraordinary analytical capability available to people around the world, that cultural change might happen faster now than it has ever happened in human history. So I want to spend a few minutes this evening talking about how I see that process and some of the components that I think it must incorporate. I can't be exhaustive. The topic of this conference covers an enormous range of material and ideas and questions. I'm going to focus on just a few, and I'm going to be quite provocative. I'm sure you'll disagree with some of what I say. But my intention, as much as anything else, is to frame the discussion, to push the boundaries a bit, and hopefully to help stimulate a really terrific conversation tomorrow. So right at the beginning, I'd just like to remind everybody about the seriousness of the situation we're facing right now. This is a graph from the 2007 IPCC report. At that time, it was generally regarded that what you see there is the green line, which is based on the A1B emission scenario from the IPCC, was the best representation of what you might call modified business as usual, or BAU. Now, though, In terms of the actual human emissions of carbon into the atmosphere, we're well above the red line, the A2 line there, which is not the worst IPCC emission scenario, but among the more pessimistic. In fact, if we continue along the kind of emissions trajectory that we are charting right at the moment, where we're looking at real increases in human emissions of carbon on an annual basis of around 3%, we will be well over 800 parts per million in terms of concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by the year 2100, over triple pre-industrial concentrations. We are going diametrically in the opposite direction of where we should be going if we want to get this problem under control. Now, as was mentioned a moment ago, this is fundamentally an energy problem. And it's an energy problem in ways that I think a lot of people don't recognize. Obviously, it's an energy problem in part because climate change is driven significantly by the releases of carbon dioxide from the combustion of fossil fuels. But it's also an energy problem because we are either now or very soon seeing the peak in global output of conventional oil. Even conservative experts are now starting to acknowledge that that peak in conventional oil output has arrived for non-OPEC countries. We're becoming increasingly dependent for, in a sense, global surge capacity for oil production, conventional oil production on OPEC countries. Sometime within the next 10 years, we are going to see the peak in global output of conventional oil and the steady decline after that. That is going to drive an increasing turn to coal. As drillers have to go farther into more hostile environments to drill deeper for smaller pools of lower quality oil, it's going to be harder to get every extra barrel. They're going to have to work harder. What's called the energy return on investment for oil will steadily drop. And as that happens, as an energy source, we're going to turn to coal. Now, as I mentioned earlier, coal is much worse for our climate environment than oil or natural gas. In the last 6 years, every single region in the world has moved from a steady decarbonization of its energy sources, which occurred over a period of almost 200 years as we moved as a species from wood to coal to oil to natural gas as principal energy sources. In the last 6 years, that trend of decarbonization has changed to a recarbonization trend in every single region of the world. And it's being significantly driven by the increasing energy cost of getting conventional oil. But there's another reason why this is fundamentally an energy problem. If you look at the great civilizations through history, and one that I've studied quite closely is Rome, in particular the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, you can quite clearly see that in many cases these civilizations ran into severe problems, economic and material problems, when they started to, in a sense, run out of energy or run out of cheap energy. When the energy return on investment, the amount of energy they get back for every unit of energy they generate, that they use to generate energy, started to drop fast. And that's the kind of transition that we're about to enter now. We're using up, or we have used up, an enormous pool of extremely cheap, high-quality energy. Now, human beings deal with their problems principally by increasing their energy use. They create more complex institutions and more complex technologies that require more energy to create and sustain. And yet we're going through a transition where energy is going to become more expensive, just at the time when we're going to need enormous amounts to cope with our increasingly difficult problems like climate change. And climate change will take a lot of energy to address. We're going to have to rebuild coastal infrastructures, move people away from coastlines quite likely, drill deeper for water, move water from newly wet areas to newly dry areas, desalinize water along coastlines, and we're going to be pumping billions of tons of carbon dioxide underground. All of that's going to require an enormous amount of energy right at the time when energy is becoming much more scarce and much more costly. This fundamental contradiction is not recognized, for the most part, by many of our policymakers. And it means, I think, essentially, that we are entering a time of enormous turbulence, where it's likely that we are going to see instabilities of various kinds develop in our global systems. There will be crises. There will be systemic breakdowns of economies, of perhaps agricultural systems, perhaps of whole societies, because of the stresses upon them that produce internal instability and violence. It will be a time of crisis, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a time of catastrophe, because we know that if we look at human history many times, it's in times of crisis that human beings are most creative, that they are most ingenious, that they actually pull together to solve their problems effectively. In fact, increasingly, I'm convinced that we probably won't address the climate change problem effectively until there are some significant salient shocks or instabilities that help mobilize people. Much will depend, ultimately, on whether we're prepared to seize those opportunities at what I call those moments of contingency, when things are very flexible, when people are scared and angry, looking for answers, and whether people who've thought about these issues a lot are able to provide some avenues for change that could be productive and can lead us to a more humane world society. And it's going to be in those times when we can see potentially sharp, nonlinear shifts in deep aspects of human societies, culture, behavioral patterns, and institutions. So the thinking that's being undertaken at this meeting is profoundly important in laying the groundwork for that nonlinear transition that will come in the future, perhaps in a time of crisis. Now, this evening, I thought that I'd focus on just four aspects of what I think the larger transformation that this conference is discussing. Four components of that larger transformation that will be essential components. And again, I could generate a very long list, but these are the ones that I think will be most provocative this evening and will give you a sense for the range of possibilities. A cognitive transition, an economic transition, a political transition, and a normative transition. I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about each of these. The cognitive transition, I think, is one that will help people understand the implications of complexity. And in turn, as a result of that deeper understanding, help societies cope with complex problems, policy problems. Now, by complexity, I mean something technical. I don't really use complexity in the conventional way that we use the word. And I want to spend a little bit of time explaining what I mean by complexity. Most fundamentally, I think we need to move from understanding the world as composed mainly of machines to understanding it as composed largely of complex systems. When I explain this idea to my students at university, I'll take in a clock that I have in my office. It looks something like this. It sits on my mantle in my office. I have a faux fireplace, and I try to make myself feel better about it, so I put this little clock above it. And I take it into the classroom, and I say, I can take this thing apart. I can break it into its component parts, its bushings, and its springs, and its cogwheels, and its screws. And I can understand how all the bits and pieces work. I can understand exactly how they fit together. And when I put them back together, if the clock isn't working properly, and by the way, it means something to say that the clock isn't working properly. That's a meaningful statement. I can point to one or two parts where the problem resides. Something's bent, something's not in the right place. So I can have a very precise understanding of this machine. And as a result of that, I can actually predict its behavior and manage its behavior quite precisely. I think many of the challenges that we face in the world today are in significant part a result of the fact that we think of the world as composed of machines like this clock, instead of thinking of it as composed of complex systems. So machines like that clock can be taken apart, they can be analyzed, they can be fully understood. Ultimately, they're no more than the sum of their parts. They exhibit what specialists call emergent properties. As I suggested before, they exhibit normal behavior or equilibrium patterns of behavior according to how we define normal for that particular machine. Most fundamentally, they show proportionality of cause and effect. Small causes cause small effects. Big causes cause big effects. And because of these first three characteristics, we can predict the behavior of this machine very accurately and manage it. Now, it's this kind of understanding that I think was at the root of disasters such as the collapse of the enormous cod fishery off the east coast of North America in the 1980s and early 1990s. Now, that was the most productive ecological system in the world. On an annual basis, it produced more biomass than any other ecological system in the world, and it's gone. Now, there were a number of very smart Canadian scientists who were charged with managing a very significant portion of that fishery, and they thought they understood it really well, and they estimated what the sustainable annual yield of so many hundreds of thousands of tons of fish might be, not realizing that there were a lot of other factors, including changes in the temperature and salinity of the water, predation of seals, heavier harvesting off the coast by Portuguese and Spanish trawlers mainly, that pushed the system from one state into another state, to another equilibrium. And complex systems like that fishery are ultimately more than the sum of their parts. They have emergent properties. You put things together, and you see things that you wouldn't have expected even with a complete knowledge of all the pieces. They can flip from one pattern of behavior to another. They have multiple equilibriums. They show disproportionality of cause and effect. Small causes can cause enormous effects. And sometimes really big changes in a system don't seem to produce any change at all. This is what specialists mean by nonlinear behavior. And as a result, as we found with that cod fishery, they can't be easily managed because their behavior can't be easily predicted. I would argue, going back to a distinction that was made originally by a well-known economist in the 1920s, Frank Knight, who's a chairman of the Department of Economics, Columbia University, that we need to distinguish between risk and uncertainty, and we need to recognize that as our world in many respects becomes more complex, or as we engage increasingly with complex systems of the kinds I've just described, we're in a world of uncertainty and not in a world of risk. In a world of risk, we can make some judgments based on empirical evidence, on the data we have available, about what pathways the systems that we're interested in, the economy, the climate, an ecological system, might develop along, and what the potential costs and benefits might be associated with moving along those pathways. In a world of uncertainty, of true uncertainty, we don't have enough information to make those judgments. We're surrounded in the famous words of Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense of the United States, by unknown unknowns. Now, I wasn't a big fan of Don Rumsfeld, as I imagine a lot of people here weren't either. But he did say one very smart thing during his career as Secretary of Defense. And it turned out that it was one of the things he was most ridiculed for. You probably remember that he said, you know, in this Iraqi theater, this is when things were going very badly in Baghdad, he said, we have known knowns, we have known unknowns, and we have unknown unknowns. And the press had a field day with this. They thought that, you know, Don has certifiably left the planet. But it turns out he was absolutely right. And it also turns out that in the American military, at least, this concept is so well understood that it's abbreviated into UNK-UNKS, UNK-UNKS. In fact, it's something that's really well understood by people who have to engage on the battlefield, who know what life is like on the battlefield. That surprises happen. Things come out of the blue. If you might remember two of the most famous things that Karl von Clausewitz wrote in his famous treatise on war back in the 19th century, he talked about friction of the battlefield and the fog of war. He was acknowledging that surprises happen, in the vernacular, that stuff happens, sometimes that you can't anticipate. In a world of unknown unknowns, you don't even know what questions to ask. You're ignorant of your ignorance. Now, we just are in the midst, perhaps the tail end, I'm not quite convinced yet, of an economic crisis of extraordinary proportion. It was caused, I think, in significant part because at a deep cultural level within the finance community, people thought they were operating in a world of risk.